The first chance of Icaea, they are the merchant caste. They deal in material goods. They engage and promote trade. They are in the business of farming, industry, commerce. They are, by and large, the scientists and those who are in industry. They have played a major role in the founding of the Indian Republic, and that for the very good reason that because they're engaged in commerce, they travel. They have a divine mandate to travel. You don't engage in business or commerce without traveling. So they do. Gandhi belonged to this caste. It was on this basis that he managed to get his education outside of India, which, be it said, made Gandhi. He belonged, incidentally, to a subcaste called the Bania, B-A-N-I-A, who were grain merchants. It was because he saw how in either the Christian West or in parts of Africa that had been heavily Christianized, he saw the injustice practiced in his own, among his own people. That is, he said he first had the concept of this being unjust. His concept of all men being created equal, he got, this is Gandhi's own statement, outside of India. These things need to be known, need to be exploited. One of my closest Jesuit friends, now teaching theology in India, did his doctorate thesis. He spent endless hours talking together in Rome. He did his doctorate thesis on Gandhi. The final caste are the Shudras. They have never been slaves. Those would be the pariahs. They are really a caste recognized and consequently authenticated by the Vedas. They are free to carry on their employment where and when they choose, which is not true of the pariahs. Their duty, divinely appointed, is to serve the upper caste. It is their privilege, so they believe, to serve the upper three castes. For example, as servants in a household, as shepherds, artisans of various kinds, workmen in all kinds of trades. They are, incidentally, forbidden to learn the Vedas proper. The four principal Vedas that we described yesterday are closed to the Shudras. They may, however, read other things, and their great epic is the Gita. As you would expect, the majority of India belongs to this caste. There are hundreds of subcastes, and they are, as I just mentioned, most of India's teeming millions. They are born to labor and are said to be, and so they believe, naturally unable to do anything better or higher. They have been so preordained. Let me just pause for a moment. Because what I want to leave with you as a result of today's lectures is some insight. I want, as I think I mentioned in our discussion last night, the variety of things that we will cover in 2 weeks is simply kaleidoscopic. And the more you read, the more that spectrum expands with hundreds of items. But there are certain basic things that I would like to leave with you. Here is one. The stratification of human nature as a preordained, predetermined constant in the world is non-Christian. It is, in the truest sense of the word, pagan. Drop the majority from the word pagan, because Hinduism, by our standards, is paganism. it is only the Judeo-Christian revelation that even begins to break through this which human nature left to itself, because we don't believe, I'm speaking as Christians, I am not now giving you Hinduism, I am now commenting as a Christian, which I wouldn't do in the university, incidentally. But that as Christians, we believe this is somehow a human construct developed by society, seeking its own welfare, and developing it into a religion. And it takes, or better, it took, the revelation of Judeo-Christianity to teach the origin of the human race from one parent. I teach creation and evolution in theology. And of course, if we were teaching this here, I would go into all the speculative details that are now clogging the theological market about original sin and evolution and so on. But somewhere at the root of our faith is the origination of the human race from God, and in such a way that we all ultimately belong to one family. And then as Christians, that God became man to redeem the whole human race. That we are therefore equal in the sight of God, having all come from one God, and having been redeemed by that same God. Close parenthesis. Outside of all the tests, and never able to become the sannyasis about whom we're going to talk in a few minutes, that is, the people who cannot reach the height of, I was going to say Christian, of Hindu perfection, are the pariahs. The Sanskrit word pariah means the untouchable one. In other words, he is not to be touched by anyone belonging to the upper, or better, belonging to the past. How may he not be touched? Well, physically, or even psychologically. To look upon a pariah renders one unclean. Their origin is unknown, that is, speaking anthropologically. However, when I teach, as I do teach, primitive religion, because in teaching comparative religion, that's my usual sequence, I begin with the primitive, they are often classed as the most certainly authentic primitives still left in the world. Because, as you know, whatever we call a primitive, and there are all sorts of definitions for what a primitive is, somehow a primitive ought to validate this definition. One who, over the centuries, has remained substantially unaffected by other religious cultures. And therefore he may be said to be in lineal descent from the Aborigines. Now we're stretching a point here because we have to go pretty far. But at least he is the most, he represents his thinking, in this case his religious thinking, he is the most antiquated, shall I say, the most archaic, that's the word, the most archaic in the world. Why? Because he has remained the most unaffected by circumambient cultures. Now, most primitives are called physical primitives. Thus, for example, in the South Sea Islands of the Pacific, or somewhere in the wilds of Africa, or of the Amazon region, still, where, as far as we can tell, stepped out of physical contact for perhaps millennia, certainly for centuries, from other cultures. The pariahs are called psychological primitives, because while physically they have been in constant, well, contact, in as much as they geographically occupied the same space that even the Brahmins or the others occupied, but given, and we have good reason to believe, that the present caste system goes back at least 1,500 years B.C. and has been sedulously observed, well, you can be sure that if part of the Vedic religion is that the castes do not have any kind of intercourse, and not just physical, as between themselves, a fortiori will they not have any kind of intercourse, whether physical or cultural, between themselves as castes and those who are outside the castes. So we can really put them back about 4,000 years, which is the longest we can put back any single religious culture as having remained out of contact, influential contact, with people who in this case were within sometimes hundreds of yards, a few hundred yards distance. They are forbidden by the most ancient laws, the pariahs, to marry anyone belonging even to the lowest caste. And of course, the nadir of exclusion and of damnation would be for one of the castes, especially the higher caste, to marry a pariah. Hinduism explains their lot as a result of a former bad life of a large class of people. In this case, it is dharma in reverse that has failed to keep the caste law, but practiced not just by an individual, but by a group of people, and therefore the whole class or the whole caste fell into its pariah condition. Since Gandhi, their lot has somewhat improved. Gandhi, as I mentioned before, did not touch the caste. He never tampered with a caste system. The most he ambitioned in one lifetime, and he hoped, by the way, to have other lifetimes, but at least in his known lifetime, the most he ambitioned to do was to help the pariah. What did he do? He got them, through the laws of the Indian Republic passed in 1950, freedom to worship in the temple and even to marry into one of the castes. But while he got that privilege for the pariahs, he did not convince the castes, by and large, they ought to go along with it. They were employed as tanners, sweepers, butchers, menial occupations of all kinds. Their history includes a number of, quote, saints, that is, of men and women who had reached, by Hindu standards, a high degree of sanctity. Now, it depends on whom you read, but there are interpreters of Hinduism who claim that a pariah can be such a good pariah, so utterly slavish, so utterly reconciled to his servile condition that he can even avoid a reincarnation. But there are not many caste Hindus that will give him that privilege. That mostly will say he can, if he behaves himself, be reborn into one of the castes. Now the third of our three levels of investigation of Hindu conduct. First was the Dharma, which is the broad perspective of Hindu ethics, which is mainly fulfilled by living out the caste system. Get that relationship, by the way. So in other words, Dharma is mainly lived out in one's own caste. And thirdly, there are ideally, and this is where Hinduism takes on the ideal order, because while the first two aspects of Hindu ethics, are still very much believed in and observed, the third, the ashramas, or the four stages, are only approximated. However, let me insert immediately, the approximation is closest among the highest castes, because as you will see, these are not easy to keep, these levels. The Brahmins, therefore, are the best observers, and a Brahmin is believed to be a good Brahmin in the degree to which he observes the ashrama, the four stages or levels of a man's existence. Others who believe in reincarnation, well, more or less despair of living out these four stages until, hopefully, they will be reborn in a higher caste. So it's a kind of postponement of this third stage of Hindu morality. Yet, these stages are believed in and practiced by the Brahmins with varying degree of fidelity. There are four stages. Technically, they obligate only the three upper classes, technically, and practically, only the first caste takes them very seriously, and even among the Brahmins, not all. The four stages are named on the board. There they are. In the middle, to the left, the Brahmachari, the Grihastha, the Vanaprastha, and the very important Sannyasi. Do you mind if we finish this, even though we go beyond the hour, and then we can take our break and then pick up the ritual? The first stage and the ashrama, therefore, is a stage. They are chronological stages. The first stage, called the Brahmachari, prescribes celibacy, and in general abstention from recognized and otherwise legitimate pleasures. Its best description is the celibate stage. And as you know, the age for marriage among the Hindus, although it's rising, is still very low. Large sections of India marry on an average at the age of 15, which, by the way, is part of their population problem, not only because of the high fertility rate, because a woman will bear from, say, the age of 15 to, well, they don't usually live quite as long as Western women do, but still long enough to have a large number of children. But also the thing is complicated because a woman at that age, just a girl, will normally not beget a strong child. And this becomes procreated. It's part of the genetic system almost. With a further result, that the children who are born of those youthful marriages, not being strong physically, they marry, their children are further weakened, and the net result is that at the other end, you have people weak way before they have reached maturity and consequently cannot contribute to the well-being of the nation. Because after all, it's not just having a lot of people, it's having a lot of people who, many of whom are weak. So the population problem twice compounded. England did something to solve the problem, but the laws of India had improved. On the other hand, they're hardly touched. And when I read, as I do, from the literature that I get from the International Planned Parenthood Association, to which I belong, cost me $15 a year. Every week, I get first-class mail from London, the latest literature and documentation, and they are heavily concentrating on India. Japan is completely gone contraceptive, and of course also abortive. When I read that, I say to myself, how criminal can you get? Of course, India has terrible population problems, but let's start where the problems are. But anyway, the first stage, the Brahmachari stage, is the celibate stage. it forbids. And depending on how faithful the Hindu is, he will practice abstention from wine, meat, therefore vegetarian diet, perfumes, for men and women, incidentally, for sweets of any kind, and for men, prescription from women. So, my notes say no wine, meat, perfume, sweets, or women. The second stage, the Vrihastha stage, first presumes that the young Hindu has studied the Vedas, and only after having come to know the Vedas is he to marry. The second stage is the household stage. He is a householder. He rears his family. He brings them up in the knowledge and the love of Brahman. And as we will see when we study the ritual, he introduces them from childhood on into the elaborate technique, almost, of Hindu worship. And he is generous with his alms. So marriage is a prescription, and rearing a family is a prescription, and being generous, philanthropic, are all prescribed. Again, I should add that Buddha, about whom we're going to speak later on, partly rebelled against this. Buddha was the one who introduced celibacy into the Orient. I mean, celibacy beyond that early stage. The third, an unusual stage, when the children have been reared, and of course they may well begin to rear their own families, have their own families at a fairly early age, so he is not that old yet. But reaching, I would say, relatively late maturity, though not old age yet. That's the last stage. The description in the literature is, when his face begins to wrinkle and his hair begins to gray. Is that nice? He is recommended to retire either alone or with his wife, and if she is living, it is recommended that the two go together. Now, when you retire to any place where they can be, or he can be, relatively alone. So the first is the state or the stage of celibacy, understanding by celibacy abstention from other types of pleasure, which he will be able to enjoy shortly. And the second is the household stage, or if you wish, the family raising stage. The third would be the retirement stage. And in this relative retirement, it isn't complete isolation, but relative retirement, to pray and to practice austerity, of which there are not a few. And by the way, yoga gives him plenty to work on. And if, as the interpreters say, if in accumulating a fortune, in making a lot of money, he has neglected his practice of yoga, well, never too late, let him start now. So many save their practice of Dharma with its various prescriptions for the third stage. I'm always looking forward to that third stage. Finally, and this is certainly the ideal, not too many reach this, though the number is considerable. There are thousands in India who reach the stage or state of sannyasi. It may be called the state of sanctity. This is the apex of human morality. During this state or stage, he leaves retirement. And now, and this may be news, now he goes about evangelizing, preaching, teaching, leading others on the road to the complete and perfect practice of Dharma. They are sometimes called, and I think the name is a misnomer, wandering ascetic. The adjective is unfortunate. They don't exactly wander. They are ascetics, but they do go about living on alms, and this is what Buddha went through and was still unsatisfied, and that's why he dropped Hinduism. He wanted something better than being just even a sannyasi.
This concludes Father Hardin's talk on morality and conduct of Hinduism. In the following tape, Father speaks on practices and beliefs of Hinduism, ritual, and worship.